Have you experienced sexual harassment in the workplace? Do you have questions about your rights? Unfortunately, sexual harassment at work continues to affect many people in Ontario. Sexual harassment can occur in many ways, from unwanted sexual comments and innuendo to sexual images on a phone or group chat to physical contact or demands for dates. It can happen at work, online, or on social media, during training, or at office parties. It can involve your boss, a coworker, or other staff. No matter what, sexual harassment at work is wrong. Ontario Legal Clinics are here to help. Know your rights. Call 1-833-677-5146 for free confidential legal advice or visit shapeyourworkplace.ca for more information.
Are you listening from inside a local prison, or do you have a friend or loved one in a local prison or youth detention center? Calls from Home is a monthly radio program for you. On Calls from Home, we share voicemails, messages, song requests, and dedications. Anyone can contact us with a message or song request for a friend or loved one on the inside. To get in touch, call or text 613-917-1390. Email cfrcprisonradio@riseup.net or send us a message on Instagram at cfrcprisonradio. The CFRC radio signal reaches the following local and regional prisons: Millhaven, Bath, Collins Bay and Frontenac, Joyceville and Pittsburgh, the Sundance Youth Detention Center here in Kingston, Quinte in Napanee, and the Cape Vincent Correctional Facility in upstate New York. Messages and song requests will be broadcast once per month on Wednesday between 7 and 8 p.m. here on CFRC 101.9 FM or on the web at cfrc.ca. For 2025, Calls from Home will air on the following dates: April 16th, May 14th, June 11th, July 9th, August 6th, September 3rd, October 1st, October 29th, November 26th, and December 24th. Please send in your message at least one day before the broadcast date. These upcoming show dates, contact info, and additional information is available online at cfrc.ca or on Instagram at CFRC Prison Radio. We look forward to receiving your messages and sharing them over the airwaves.
This episode of the Kingston Live podcast is brought to you by Grand On Stage. Get the most out of the Kingston Grand Theatre experience with access to pre-sale tickets, the best prices, and the best seats. Tickets for individual performances and subscriptions for the Grand On Stage season are on sale now at kingstongrand.ca.
If you drive southwest from downtown Kingston, past City Park and Queen's University, you'll find a place unlike any other in the city. One that in just a little over 10 years has established itself as a premier destination for music from all across the world in a room built to sound crisp and clear. This is Kingston Live, and today's episode is a special one, presented in two parts. We're sitting down in the Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts, and we're joined by a guest that's played a major role in getting the Isabel to where it is today. Gordon E. Smith has been part of the Isabel since the very beginning. A former vice dean in the Faculty of Arts and Science and director of the School of Music at Queen's, Gordon is the director of the Isabel, a role that puts him in charge of setting the course for the facility and stewarding its future. By drawing from his background in ethnomusicology, Gordon has led multiple seasons of performances, consisting of dozens of diverse acts from across Canada and beyond. Peter sits down with Gordon to discuss the Isabel's past, its significance in the community, and its future as not only a destination for great performances, but a space of cultural development and connection.
Now, I'd like to get started. The Isabel is a lot of things to a lot of people. From your perspective, could you tell me a little bit about sort of how you would describe the Isabel to someone that hasn't been here before, sort of uninitiated?
Well, it's the Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts. It's a performing arts center. The performance hall is kind of the centerpiece of the place, but we have other performance spaces in the Isabel. But the answer to your question, I would say, is it's a really important kind of cultural, artistic venue for not just Kingston and the surrounding area, but for Ontario, Eastern Canada, and even nationwide now. It has a reputation for high level, high standard of artistic production and for live performance and for recording. It's part of Queen's University, the Isabel. I think it's important to remember that. We, the Isabel, have a dual mandate, public facing and an educational one. This is a teaching building. What you see in the lobby there, those are students. Those are real students. They're going to classes. They're waiting for classes. They're coming for classes. This is a busy place all the time during the academic term. So we have, as I say, this dual mandate. That's part of it. On the third floor is the Department of Film and Media with classrooms. There are four classrooms up there, editing suites, instructors like professors' offices, meeting rooms. There's a library up there for the department. On the second floor, there's a film screening room. These are all teaching spaces. This is all part of the educational part. On this level, in the recital hall, that's a teaching space as well, mostly for the dance school, for music and acting, the studio theater, which is just down the hall. We teach drama students, acting, movement, lighting, related sort of drama subjects in there. So there's a lot of activity going on. We also have an art and media lab on the north side of the building, which is used for teaching installations and exhibit space. We also use all of these spaces that I just named, the recital hall, the studio theater, the film screening room, and the art and media lab as public spaces as well when they're not being used for teaching. So we double that. And this, the performance hall, is also used for student concerts. So in terms of Kingston, it was originally sort of contemplated as a performing arts center by the university to complement what's already here. When a performing arts center was first contemplated at the university back in the early 2000s, I was a faculty member, or I still am a faculty member, but I was a faculty member in music then, and I was actually the head of the department. So because I was in that administrative role, they said they wanted input from the music school, from the film media department, from the drama department, from visual art, all the arts departments on what could this performing arts center be, what could it look like, why do we need it. And the sort of underlying theme and the most pressing sort of argument, the most effective argument, I would say, was Queen's doesn't have an acoustically superior performance hall for music. Other universities have something much more substantial. We were doing in music performances in Grant Hall, which is not a music space at all. It's used for all kinds of things, rarely for music. Dunning Auditorium in Dunning Hall. We had spaces that were really not at all designed for music. Very often, no backstage, no instruments. You had to move everything there. So we need a recital hall or a concert hall. And then music was sort of saying this the most loudly and most vociferously, but the other arts departments also talked about needs. At that point, the film department was in two old houses on Stewart Street, which were very dilapidated. They were most in need of new premises. The art department was in Ontario Hall. The music school is in Harrison LeCain Hall, but it was the film and media department that sort of won out. There wasn't enough room when this the Performing Arts Center was designed to move all the arts departments here, creative arts departments here, which is what we wanted. We wanted, and there was talk about trying to get the adjacent land. It would have had to be a bigger footprint and way more expensive.
Yeah,
this is already a scale back from the original scope of the project. So in the end, film and media got to move in. It has these wonderful premises on the third floor, and the old houses on Stewart Street are gone. They've been taken down. The center opened in 2014. Yep. It took at least 3 years to build it. By the time that, even more than that, there's a picture of when the first shovel went in the ground. I think it was like late 2009 or something like that. So it was a long, protracted process, a very complicated one, which had to do with the site and the buildings that were here. I don't know if you'd like me to say anything about that or
Oh no, I was actually going to bring that up. So at this point, the Isabel is in its 11th year of programming.
That's right.
Yeah. And obviously a lot has happened since that time. You've been involved in the development of the space and currently its stewardship. I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about sort of the origins of the project, like the circumstances that led to the decision to build it the way it was designed.
Yeah, that's a great question too. It sort of follows from what I was just talking about. Mm-hmm. The funding for it, it was contemplated, the space, the need for the space, but oh, it's going to cost a lot of money. We don't know where are we going to site it, mm-hmm. the Performing Arts Center. This is before we ever got this land, and there were all kinds of ideas that I won't go into, like other locations. Mm-hmm. But thanks to a couple of really effective senior administrators, one, the Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Science at that time, Bob Silverman, Tom Harris, Daniel Wolf, they were real champions of the need for a performing arts center. There were other people too. I don't want to leave people out, but those were some of them. They were really effective fundraisers and had great relationship with Alfred Bader and Isabel Bader. And in a number of conversations, and this goes back to probably 2007, 2008, they won the Baders over in terms of making the sort of transformative gift of over $30 million that they did to build the Isabel. Before that, the university bought this property that we're sitting on here in 2007 from the City of Kingston. The City of Kingston owned both the Tet Center and this, and then Corrections Canada owns the upper part, the Red Cross building, Morton House, Stone Gables, and the other house, the mansion that's called Morton House up there. This property was bought from the City of Kingston. They kept the Tet Center. And what was bought here was the Stella Buck building, which is still here. It gets behind where we're sitting. The stone walls on the west side of the Isabel are the walls of the old Stella Buck building. And the stable, which is now the Art and Media Lab, which is to the north side, these were the buildings that were bought by Queens, this and this footprint down to the water, and the parking lot, just the first little parking lot to the west here. The rest of this property all belongs to Corrections.
It's hard to imagine a location sort of better than the one that it ended up in, like the Isabel being right on the waterfront and incorporating a lot of those natural elements and incorporating the old buildings as well.
Right. It was. I have to say, it was Karen Hitchcock who was the principal at the time. She negotiated the sale of the property with the city. And it was, I think, a real legacy to Karen's leadership. And actually, the recital hall is named after her. And she was a great friend of the Baders as well. So when the university bought the property, the gift hadn't been made. Mm. It was like, someday, hopefully we can do something with that property. And then a couple of years later, the Baders made that gift, and then that sort of leveraged money from three levels of government, like municipal, provincial, and federal, and then a capital fundraising campaign at Queens. The names are on the donor wall out in the lobby, and so it was kind of a combined effort to get to the, it was in the low $72 million that it cost to build this place.
It's interesting to hear the low 72 million.
yeah, I think it was 72 or 73. Mm-hmm. But it was, that was a scaled back version. It would, originally there were going to be more spaces. It was going to be bigger. But like any kind of project like this, the cost overruns. Just the longer it takes, the price goes up. And here, this was a very challenging site with a historical building, the Stella Buck building. Also, when they started to dig, they found all kinds of munitions underground. Oh, wow. That they didn't know were there. This was an army base for a good part of the 20th century. And like there were warships here and so on. And there were things that they sort of discovered once they went down there that had to be removed in a very sensitive manner, which slowed it down. Yeah. And also the walls. Heritage Kingston was insistent that the Stella Buck building not be taken down. So he kept the stone walls. We had to have the heritage architects that helped. They took the roof off, but the walls had to be propped up or they would have fallen over. The windows, there were all kinds of heritage elements that were really important and critical to preserve. That took time and it cost money. So we had two sets of architects, N45, the heritage architects, they're Ottawa-based, and Snøhetta. It's an architectural firm based in Oslo in Norway. Mm-hmm. The architects that built the design, the Isabel, were from the New York office. This was the first Canadian project, but that went out to tender. We interviewed, I think, six sets of architects, and Snøhetta won the contract. They were very drawn to the site. Mm. They love working with water, with different sort of landscape. They love the stone, the limestone. They were really attracted to the physical dimensions of the place, mm-hmm. and reflect that in the design, both of the hall and of the building. Last year, when we had the 10th anniversary, we invited them back, the Snøhetta team and the N45 team, and they made presentations right here on the stage talking about this and how they sort of imagined and conceived the design mm-hmm. of not just the performance hall, but the whole structure and how they integrated it with the historical part and the challenges of that, but how pleased they are with them. Mm-hmm.
They had also worked on the Oslo Opera House.
Yes.
Correct? And it's interesting to see the sort of commonalities between those two spaces. They both integrate a lot of the natural elements of the area. They are both on the waterfront, of course. Was that a big factor in choosing to work with them?
Their presentation, when you're looking for a firm to take a bid, the company comes in and makes a presentation. Their presentation was brilliant in terms of articulating about the place, the space, the landscape. I mean, this is not a standard site for a performing arts center. On the contrary, it was a very odd site. I mean, it was pretty beside the water, but it had this old building and the Tet Center beside it, which is, let's face it, that it has its challenges. And how are you going to make this? Mm-hmm. Not just look like something, but create something meaningful that works on the site. And they were very drawn to that challenge.
Yeah. Well, it seems like they've met that challenge, I suppose.
Yeah, they were very also attracted sort of by the light, the way the light changes here. And those of us who work here are here every day notice it. It's really interesting with the lake and the sky and the different seasons of the year, how the light can change and sort of affect different perspectives. And they play with that, not just with all the glass, but some of it is slightly tinted. The cladding on the new part, that is brilliantly done. It reflects. It doesn't blind you. But it's stunning in the daytime and at night.
Yeah, it really makes a strong first impression. Mm-hmm. Now, the space itself in the performance hall is designed for classical music originally, correct?
I think that is correct. Mm. But classical music, I like to think of it as broadly defined. We do all kinds of music in here, mostly acoustic. Sometimes it's slightly amped, but we're not doing dancing here. We don't have a pit. It's a very different setup than the Grand Theater as a point of comparison, or even the Thousand Island Playhouse. This is purpose-built for music.
This episode of Kingston Live is brought to you by Grand Onstage. Grand Onstage takes you beyond the regular Kingston Grand Theater experience. It's a subscription option that gives you access to pre-sale tickets, the best prices, and the best seats. That means you can customize your own individual package starting at just 4 performances. Want to bring friends? Subscriber pricing applies to their tickets too. And if your plans change, just exchange your tickets for another performance. Tickets for individual performances and subscriptions for the Grand Onstage season are on sale now at kingstongrand.ca.
It's interesting the breadth of performances that come through, but also of events that come through. Like, it's a multi-use space in a lot of ways, like KCFF coming up, so Kingston Canadian Film Festival. Screens films here. I saw there's actually several of them this year.
Yep.
But also there's a lot of local music that comes through too, in addition to all the international talent that comes through. Can you tell me a bit about the intentionality of choosing who performs here?
That's a great question. there's a couple of things that are the Isabel program, the Isabel season, the 26-27 season, which will start officially next September. It's all planned, and we're announcing it in April. Try to balance the genres. Usually we have about 26 or 27 shows from September through to May. This year we're going to have a summer season with 3 kind of spotlight summer shows in June and July. That's new. But I would say about 30. Mm-hmm. And looking at like who... Pianists, chamber music, trios, string quartets, here's your classical music. If there's an orchestra, certain kinds of vocal music. But we've had like a mariachi band, we've had a gospel choir, swing band, like big band jazz. Mm-hmm. Zakir Hussain, a couple of years ago, sold the place out. He's an amazing, he actually passed away, but he's a tabla player. Mm. That was a highlight concert, but that's classical music too, but it's Indian classical music.
Yeah.
It's not Western classical music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like over the years, the Isabel's really established itself as a reputation for bringing in a very diverse and wide variety of music and filling sort of role in the city that previously, like, you know, there are other venues that bring in sort of mid-level and upper-level artists, but the diversity of music that comes through here is staggering.
Well, that's a strategic priority, is diversity. In Maps Onto the University, we're part of Queens, and like indigenization, equity, diversity, inclusion, anti-racism, accessibility, this is a strategic priority of the university in all aspects of it, operations and programming, and it is here too, very much so. It's at the very beginning, the top of our strategic plan. Mm. And so that is reflected, hopefully, in the programming that we do here. We have to balance, but we also have to be mindful of that. That helps as well to engage students. It helps to engage different, like, diverse audiences, not just a standard kind of classical Western music, older, if I can use that word, audience, but bring in new demographics, which the diversifying the programming really helps. One, in Indigenous programming as well, is something I really try to focus on in each season, to have a number of, if not whole shows, but aspects of shows that reflect indigenization in either the artists who are performing or what they're performing, and to make that known to the audience as well. We've had some great Indigenous performances here over the years.
Yeah, I know. And even that's represented in the residencies that happen here as well, correct?
Very much so.
Now, we talked a bit about the development of the Isabel, the way that it came to be. And since 2014, Kingston has culturally and artistically developed as well. How does the development of Kingston, how is it reflected in the Isabel, or is it reflected in the Isabel?
To some extent, I think what we're talking about here with diversifying programming and bringing in artists from sort of different cultural and ethnic constituencies reflects this. And this is, Kingston has really sort of expanded in terms of performances, performance venues, artists who are brought here. So it's important for us as a performing arts center to be part of the whole and not sort of competing. I really work at it, and so colleagues in other venues, other presenters in Kingston feel the same. I think we need to collaborate with each other and not work sort of independently, or even worse than that, sort of against each other, because it's obviously not a very productive, it's totally counterproductive way to do it. So really trying to communicate. One thing that I think your listeners will be interested in is the relationship between the Isabel and the Grand Theater. When the Isabel was built, there was a cultural feasibility study that the city of Kingston and the university commissioned to talk about cultural venues in Kingston. This is, I think, in 2005, 2006. It's around the time the university bought this property.
Yeah.
And it was a study. It talked about the need for collaboration in a small urban center like Kingston, with two universities here in Queens and in RMC, to work together strategically and thoughtfully. This hall is smaller than the Grand Theater by 200 seats, maybe not quite that much, but it is smaller. Well, why are you only having 567 seats? Why don't you have more seats than that? Well, the Grand Theater already has more seats. Also, we wanted a music, the acoustic superior hall. The Grand Theater was not designed for that. I'm not saying it's not good for certain things, but it's not acoustically a superior space, and they would say that. So this complements the Grand.
Yeah.
So the Grand does a certain kind of programming. We do certain kind of programming. Sometimes they overlap, but not a lot. Try to complement. Same thing with the Playhouse is not so much, again, an awkward Playhouse. It's theatrical, so we're not working so closely there. But the Broom Factory, for example, brings artists. We have now a Friday night series in the recital hall. where we've been bringing in local community groups, small groups like pop indie groups.
Yeah.
Well, the Brim does that. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be careful that we're not competing, but just duplicating.
Well, and it's great to hear that because it's always interesting being in this performance hall because it sounds tremendous. Like, it's an incredible sounding room, but it is also a very intimate room. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of cliche to say that there's not like a bad seat in the house, but there really isn't. Like, it's just this complete space, and it doesn't need to, I guess, override any other space in the city. It has its own unique properties, and it's a great addition to the landscape. Now, one other thing I wanted to talk about, we briefly touched on it, but one element of the Isabel that I don't think gets kind of enough attention is the residency features of the space, like the Isabel's Imagine Arts Incubator, and also just the recordings that happen here. Can you tell me a little bit about the approach to that?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought that up. The Imagine Arts Incubator is a program that actually Tricia Baldwin, my predecessor as director here, started in 2020 during COVID, during the shutdowns. She was brilliant in terms of coming up with this concept. It's an opportunity for artists to come and do recordings here, which they're subsidized. They get an honorarium, they get the space, they get the equipment, the technicians, it's provided. We still have the Imagine program. It's slightly different than the original was community-based. Now it's national. We run an annual competition for Imagine projects. This year we selected 6. This is a philanthropically funded program. Mm. So we can't afford to take as many as we would like. That said as well, we don't have the capacity because we program in here. These are recordings. So the recording is taking place in here. We can't have a show in here when there's a recording going on in here. So we have to balance that. As a recording venue, it's a very sought-after place. We have the New Orford String Quartets recorded here, the Griffin Trios recorded here. A number of like leading performing artists have recorded here. It's known as a destination, mm-hmm. a recording destination. The access is great. It's not a complicated place to get to. It's easy to stay here. And more than anything, it's acoustically the best you can get mm-hmm. for recording. And we have not just great equipment, but a really skilled tech team for the recording. So the Imagine program runs now annually. The other project I wanted to mention was the competitions.
Yeah.
This is now our fourth competition. 2017 was the first one, which was violin. 2020 was cello, and that was during the shutdown. That was done online. 2023 was piano, and 2026 is piano. We're doing another piano. So the competitions are on a 3-year cycle. These are supported philanthropically as well, mm-hmm. and they're supported by Bader Philanthropies, which is the foundation, the sort of legacy foundation of Alfred and Isabel Bader.
Well, and you mentioned the 6 nominees for this year's cycle, and the range of musicality there is incredible. Like I remember Sylvie Cheng, she's a pianist. You have composers, and you also even have some local representation. I noticed Oscar Evans, isn't there.
Yeah.
And it kind of ties back to this being both a kind of queen space, a space that brings in a lot of international talent, but also a sort of distinctly local one.
For sure. There's a mix of that for sure. If you go sort of drill into the projects a little bit more, like the Sylvie Cheng project, that's a recording project she's doing with a colleague, a pianist colleague, on music by women composers. Mm-hmm. Every single one of those projects has some sort of socially motivated, like music as a social process, music as a cultural process, music as identity affirmation or emancipation or something like that. There's an activism component to these projects, which sort of elevates them, distinguishes them from just recording mm-hmm. for the sake of recording. There's a motivation that the applicants sort of articulate that speaks to these themes, which are priorities in the Imagine program.
And speaking of the space, we've talked a bit about the sort of history of it, but at the end of the day, about 12-ish years of operation with a few years before, the space is very young still. Mm-hmm. As the director of the Isabel, what is your approach today to stewarding the space as its legacy is still being defined?
Well, its identity is still being defined. So we're still trying to figure out who we are.
Yeah.
And that, I don't know if we ever will. I don't think that's possible anymore because everything's changing so fast in the world in which we live. Nothing is sort of fixed.
Yeah.
So it's, the arts are like constantly in flux more than ever. You know, and the performing arts sector is incredibly challenged. Coming out of COVID is one thing, but it always was. For centuries, it has been. In a situation like this, the Isabel is part of a university where there are professional faculties, as you would well know, that are high priorities. Yeah, engineering, applied science, business, law, health sciences. The performing arts is not anywhere close to that in terms of research priorities, academic priorities. It's still a kind of nice to have. Mm. That makes it a challenge. But we're making progress. Getting people, even doing a conversation like this is a good way of sharing who we are and who we aspire to be.
Yeah.
And the kinds of things that we're doing, the actions that we're doing to get there. It's a place, it's a presence, and as long as it's a living presence that is meaningful to the people who come here, the students, the all different kinds of audiences, the people who work here, and the impact of the arts on different groups. I think we're doing what we want to do.
Yeah, given that the space feels very alive in a way that I think is sort of unique to a performance hall. As you mentioned, like, because students are studying here, like, there's constantly activity. If you just came by on, you know, an average Tuesday, there's people around, there's things happening, there's creativity in the air. It feels like a space that is meeting that approach and that expectation. We've talked a lot about the development of the space, and you'd mentioned the story of finding munitions here when they were developing. Mm-hmm. Are there any other pieces of the Isabel's history that you wish more people knew about?
If you go down the hall on the west side of the south side of the performance hall, we put up some photos that were taken when the Isabel was being built. You could see, for example, the stone walls of the Stella Buck building. I don't think people realize that was actually a building. It's not just stone that was put up on the west side. This is from like the 1830s or 1840s. It's like historic. It's nearly 200 years old. The area was a distillery and a brewery at the Tet Center. That was the brewery that Stella Buck, the building, that what was happening on the Isabel site was, I think, a distillery. But whatever, it was an alcohol-producing site. Mm-hmm. And obviously, there was sort of running across the lake with, you know, the proximity of the lake inspired the people who were into that business to use these sites. And for most of the 19th century, that's what it was. It was a brewery and a distillery. That finished at the beginning of the 20th century. And it was a hospital during the First World War up till about 1924. Mm. And the Stella Buck building was part of the hospital. And Stella Buck, after whom that building was named, was a nurse in the hospital. And the Red Cross building across, they were all related to that medical sort of use of the site during the First World War. And after that, the property was bought by the city. And in 1924 to 1968, it was run as Eastern Army headquarters. It was a military headquarters. So there, where the munitions come from, I don't know where, but there was certainly, there's some kind of a warship that sunk just off here. Divers go looking for it to this day. In the summer, you see people diving, and there's a ship there.
Jeez,
a sunken ship out there. It's connected to this history. It's very interesting. I don't have all the details of this, but it's a fascinating site on the shore, you know, just of like the Kingston area.
So we've got, at one point, medical facilities. We have a brewery.
Yeah.
We have military.
That's right.
We have music.
That's right.
If that doesn't sum up Kingston, I don't really know what does.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Gordon, thank you for sitting down with me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for being here, Peter.
This has been Kingston Live. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please share it, tell a friend, or subscribe on your platform of choice. For show listings, artist info, and all things Kingston music, check out kingstonlive.ca. Kingston Live was produced in Kingston by Soundwise. Recorded on location at the Isabel, with assistance by Timothy Andrews, Alan Bergeron, Aaron Holmberg, Thomas Liguisto, and Jesse McMillan. Hosted by Peter Sanfilippo. Voiceover by John Sanfilippo. Executive producer Rob Howard. We'd love to hear from you. Email us at podcast@kingstonlive.ca.
Guys, gals, non-binary pals, different circles is moving. Same day, different time slot. We're now on Fridays at 9 p.m. Join me from 9 to 10 p.m. for an adventure through sound. Who knows? You might just find your next favorite song.
Thank you.